Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining Gregor Robertson and I today, it is Alison Rudd. Alison, good afternoon to you. You are Liverpool champions. How does it feel now? It's finally confirmed.
feels nice. And I just love the way people congratulate the fans. So people... I get a lot of congratulations, like I had something to do with it. And it's always that way. I remember when I was in Istanbul, I had about, I don't know, 800 texts from people saying, well done you.
Yeah.
And in the end, it goes to your head and you think, yes, I think it probably was a lot to do with me.
Well, I thought, there I'm thinking I'm speaking to Alison who plays in goal. No, that's not right, obviously.
Well, that's just an added bonus, isn't it?
Yeah. Are you still celebrating? And how did you celebrate on Thursday?
Well, I didn't really deep down want it to be that way. I wanted Liverpool to sort of actively be on the pitch when they won it by defeating Man City. But it happened, and I knew I'd get a wave of emotion, and I did. I did shed a tear. I then immediately put up this enormous champions flag that I'd pre-ordered, breaking all the rules of superstition, but I felt pretty secure. And put that out. It's enormous, actually. And then, weirdly, I went to bed and dreamt about my granddad, and it was a really intense dream. My granddad's dead, and I found him, and we were hugging. And I woke up crying, aww. And I thought, why have I dreamt about my granddad? And then I saw my flag. It's in my bedroom window. I saw it, and I realised it was because my granddad's the reason I'm a Liverpool fan. So my deep, deep subconscious sort of went full circle, and I was sort of talking to him about it in some way. And my granddad took football very seriously. He wasn't a joyful man. And I'm not a joyful fan, really. I don't sing at games, and I don't scream in delight. I take it very seriously. I was a very serious child about football. And I haven't been jumping up and down and getting drunk. I've been sort of feeling nostalgic and happy, but also a bit emotional as well.
Yeah.
And I think fans are probably in two groups, and I'm in the group that sort of goes into the nostalgia of it. I mean, you never feel like you did when you were a child. When I was a child, I would actually cry, sob, and I believed I was the only person in the world who cared about the team, that no one else would hurt as much as me if they lost. So it just depends what your relationship is. So I didn't do a silly jig, but I've told the world I'm proud by flying my flag anyway.
Oh, I love that, though. I love that you had a little dream about your granddad. That's lovely. Gregor, what kind of a fan are you when we hear how Alison supports Liverpool? How are you? What are you
I was just, first of all, there, I was just picturing Alison really actually singing and supporting a team from the press box. That's a good image. But what kind of fan was I? I think I was the same. I was quite emotional as a kid. I would, as I said, I was always crying my eyes out if Celtic or Scotland lost. But that's been thoroughly drummed out of me after a career playing football for a living. So I'm not a fan any longer, I'm afraid.
Oh, we need to get that back, no?
A fan of football rather than any one particular team now, I think.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll let you off. How are you otherwise? You good, Gregor?
I'm good, yes. I'm just thoroughly enjoying this festival of football now. After a bit of a slow start, I think it's actually, there's so much to play for at both ends of the table, in the Premier League and in the Championship. It's kind of, there's so much still to be played for, despite Liverpool's title being sealed now, and lots to look forward to. So, yeah, really enjoying it.
Well, talking of the Championship coming up, we are looking at a devastating few days for Wigan Athletic and discussing the potential first managerial casualty of the restart. Lots for us to get through then.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're going to start at a pulsating game at the London Stadium where West Ham gave their survival hopes a huge boost with an unexpected 3-2 victory over Chelsea. Andrei Yarmolenko stepped off the bench to hit the winner as the Hammers shrugged off VAR controversy to complete a league double over Chelsea for the first time since 2003 when they were relegated from the Premier League. David Moyes' side had controversially been denied an opener from Thomas Suchek's strike, which was scrubbed out by VAR, but they battled back from Willian's penalty to lead when Suchek and Mikel Antonio netted either side of the break. Then a superb free kick from Willian looked to have shared the points until a breakaway saw Antonio tee up Yarmolenko to cut past Antonio Rudiger to fire home in the 89th minute. Gregor, we'll come to you. This result, has this sort of turned the tide, do you think, for West Ham?
It's certainly a huge result. I mean, after the results from the restart, which have been, you know, they've looked organised and solid, and there's always been moments, kind of either an error or a breakaway that's kind of cost them. And it looked again after the offside, you know, that the luck was going to be against them again. But they showed a lot of fortitude and they went right to the end and came back very well. And it's a huge result because if you look at the run-in now, there are some kind of winnable games. Norwich are out of it now, although it pains me to say that. I think they're looking doomed. So, you know, they've got Norwich and Burnley are in a great shape, but they've got a bit of kind of and a bit of turmoil off the pitch as well. So they've got some winnable games coming up now. And that game last night was not one of the games that they would have kind of earmarked to get 3 points from. So huge win for them.
Huge win it certainly was. Alison, does this result confirm David Moyes is the right man to lead West Ham?
Well, right now, it looks like he is going to pull off the escape, doesn't it? He's getting a bit of a reputation for being one of those firefighter managers as opposed to one that builds a dynasty of his own. I was at the game they lost against Spurs, and I have to say, you cannot fault David Moyes' energy for the fight and the intensity with which he sort of emanates it. And I do feel that at this stage of the season, if he's sort of giving off that aura of we can do it, it does help. So I certainly, between now and the end of the season, I think the board would be mad if there's another wobble to dump him. He's got all the right attributes. What's wrong with the team really is more historical than that. So it's right now with what he's the manpower he's got. He's got a fit Antonio, which I think is probably the most important thing for him. And then if he can just maintain that sense of discipline. I mean, one of the significant things other than Antonio's brilliance last night for West Ham was that they just kept their concentration levels. There was some really good defending from the players, and that has to come from the manager telling them they can do it and having a plan of action and convincing them to stick to it no matter what unfolds in the game. And you know, they could have crumpled with some of the decisions that went against them, and they didn't. And you know, it was hard. I think it'd be hard for anybody, for a fan of any team other than perhaps Chelsea, to not think, actually, good on them. That was a tough game. Lesser teams would have crumpled, and they did not. They stuck at it, and the winning goal, while it did make Chelsea look slightly stupid, it was beautiful. So they've got talent in that team, and I think I do, to answer your question, I think David Moyes is at the moment he's making mostly the right decisions with what he's got available.
Gregor, when you are in a relegation battle, as West Ham have been, how much, especially when you're in a run-in like this now with just a few games left, how much is mental stability important as well?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it, you know, Alison's right. He is someone who's done this before. He does, although he can come across as the kind of dour Scotsman, and I can say that because I won't say I'm dour, but I'm a Scotsman. he does kind of do his best to instill them with belief. But I think more importantly than that is the fact that they look well organised. And, like, you know, that might sound silly considering they lost to Spurs and Wolves, but as I say, those were games that were decided on moments. Adama Traore came on and won the game for Wolves. Spurs had a very fortunate goal. I think it was a Suchek own goal. And then Kane broke away and scored towards the end. So, you know, those games were tight, were turned on moments. And as I say, it looked like they were going to be unlucky again last night, but they kept going and they kept going. And as Alison said, they look well organised. And that you have to give Moyes credit for that.
Well, like Alison said, there were moments where they could have crumbled against Chelsea. For the first time in a while on this podcast, we have some VAR controversy. Taking to the 34th minute, Thomas Suchek's goal was disallowed following a VAR review for an offside offence against Mikel Antonio. Now, the on-field decision was to award the goal, but the VAR advised the referee that Antonio was in an offside position and directly in the line of vision of the goalkeeper, Kepa. Now, former Premier League referee Peter Walton has written in the Times today saying that VAR Jonathan Moss took 3.5 minutes to reach a decision. VAR should only be used to correct clear and obvious errors. That it took Moss so long to make up his mind shows that the incident was far from clear or obvious. Alison, should the goal have stood?
Of course it should have stood. Oh, I'm trying. I fail every time not to utter a deep sigh. I apologise. But it does this to me. It's
This is VAR you're talking about when you're sighing, isn't it? Not just us.
It's not you, Nat. No.
Yeah, every time I speak to you guys, it gets to me, you know? But no, a VAR, if it has any role at all, it's to stop things, miscarriages of justice that everyone can see on telly at home. What you don't want is a clear goal to be ruled out through human error that does not have access to a replay, whereas everybody at home can see what should have happened, and it makes officials embarrassed and the game look stupid. That's the only advantage to having a review system. Nobody at any point has ever said, oh, we really want to be able to give one man in a room the chance to mull something over for half his life. That is not what it's about. And no way, pre-VAR, I would have thought, you know, 99 out of 100 officials would have allowed that goal to stand. It's perfectly clear, even if you want to review it and look at it again, that Kepa was not impeded by Antonio's head lying on the floor. His own defender was muscling around, yes, in front of him, being, yes, stupid. So it was a perfectly valid goal, and B, this is a misuse of technology and the ability to have replays, because all you do is you can imagine being in that room, looking at the monitor and thinking, oh, well, you know, I suppose technically his head, he can score with his head, and his head's, you know, he's probably offside. I mean, you can get completely wrapped up in it. And this is not what football is about. It's not about fine print and being able to look at something 100 times just in case. It's about the spirit of the game and what it feels like at the time. VAR is only there to stop, as I say, massive miscarriages of justice, not these little minuscule things that nobody would get cross about. Nobody in the world would have been cross if VAR didn't exist and that was given as a goal. That's the point. That's the rule of thumb, surely.
Gregor, do you agree?
First of all, I've missed hearing Alison being exasperated about VAR. It's good to have that back. I do agree, but I think clear and obvious is gone. That was supposed to be the purpose for VAR. That was supposed to be when it intervened. But that's been completely lost. Any kind of decisive moment, a goal, is that all subjectivity has been lost. So I'm not saying that's right, but that's just the way it is. I think the clear and obvious thing has completely disappeared, and I don't really know why that is. So, I mean, I think it should have been a goal, as Alison said. If someone's analysing it for so long, that's that is not the spirit of the game. But again, this is something that people are split into two camps over. Some people want it to be, you know, they say, how can offside be anything but objective? I mean, without a kind of change of the rules, I don't see how that's going to change personally.
Well, what about putting a time limit on VAR reviews? That's something that Peter Walton has also suggested. Would you be in favour of that, Alison?
Well, it's as a halfway house, making it slightly better, yes. But only because it might stop ridiculous decisions being made, i.e. when it takes a couple of minutes to draw all the lines and to prove that somebody's bottom is offside. If it speeds up for general enjoyment of the game, tick, yes, that's fine. And also speeds it up, because if it's so marginal you need to draw 50 lines and think about it for half an hour, then there can't be an issue. But I think ultimately, if you impose a time limit, you're sort of accepting the system, and I would say the system is wrong. So it would be a partial help, but I really want why we have VAR to be thought about again from scratch. Scratch it all and then start again about what we've learned from it, what's good and what's bad, and have a completely new way of looking at replays.
Just from what you've just said there then, Alison, what good can you take from VAR right now?
Well, like I say, obvious miscarriages of justice. Uh-huh. If the people see the truth and it is denied them, then they will be upset. No one wants that. And I think if referee on the field of play would like to be able to see something again, because and they often have very good reason to need to see something again, something obscuring their view, or there was a distraction, or they were incorrectly placed for an incident and their assistants aren't sure. I think it's good for the referee who has the responsibility of the match. It's his match, he's in charge, rather than deferring to somebody who isn't there and hasn't, as I said before, got the pace of the game and understand what's going on. And also, the other thing is, I don't think I have said before, people in football always bang on about consistency, and players and managers will say, all I want is a bit of consistency from the officials. Mm-hmm. If you've got one game in which two different referees are making decisions, that is ultimately lack of consistency. So I think if reviews are used, it should be the referee, because then he can apply not only what he sees on the monitor, but he can apply his interpretation of how the match has unfolded and all the various factors that nobody knows unless they're there in the middle of the pitch, part of the action, which a referee is. So I would say there's a it's not ridiculous to keep part of it, but as long as you give more power back to the match official.
See, I had to ask Gregor, didn't I? I had to ask Alison if there were some positives to take from VAR. But let's focus on the positives, perhaps, for West Ham. It was their first point since the restart. We've mentioned they have had defeats to Wolves and Tottenham. And Gregor, you did mention some of their remaining games. It's Newcastle away first, then Burnley at home, Norwich away, Watford at home, Manchester United away and Aston Villa at home. When you consider all of those fixtures, Gregor, are you positive that West Ham can stay up?
Positive may be pushing it a little bit, but I think part of the reason that was such a big win is because, I mean, the teams below them really do look in dire straits. Villa are, I think really the bottom three currently is most likely to go down now, because Villa have shown very little since the restart. Bournemouth, we're going to come on to, are in dire straits. And Norwich look all but doomed now. So, I mean, that's why it was such a big win. I forgot about Newcastle before Burnley and Norwich. But, these next three games, they could, realistically, create a bit of daylight between themselves and the bottom three. So, certainly hugely, hugely positive for them. And I just think there's some positive performances too. I mean, Alison said Antonio, there are times when he can run the ball out of play, but there are other times where he looks unplayable, And Jared Bowen as well, he's just... I was so surprised it took him this long to be signed by a Premier League team, because he just, almost every game he plays in, or he played in for Hull, he either scored or he created a goal, or often both. And he just started where he left off with Hull. He always does that, you know. He's just got that kind of touch, that Midas touch. So there are definitely some positives going forward like that. And as I say, with him looking well organised and well drilled at the back, I think it does look a lot better for West Ham than it did 24 hours ago.
Well, some West Ham fans may well be feeling positive after that result against Chelsea. And we will talk about Bournemouth in more detail. But of course, Alison, you were at Bournemouth Newcastle this week. Their next game, as I was saying, for West Ham is away to Newcastle. How tough a challenge from what you saw at Bournemouth will Newcastle be? Do they look rejuvenated in some way?
Well, it depends which Newcastle turn up. If the Newcastle I watched at Bournemouth last night turn up, then that's a really tough game for anybody. I have to say, it might be the best I've ever seen Newcastle play in my entire life.
Ooh.
And I'm not trying to be, you know... I honestly can't think of a time where I've been as impressed by them. They, apart from conceding a very, very late goal, it was almost perfect. Their attitude was amazing. They just looked 3 inches taller than Bournemouth. They looked fitter. They were so vocal with each other. They looked like a team about to clinch something really important. They looked incredibly well motivated, well balanced. There was everything. They did the dirty things. They did the creative things. Maybe it's playing in orange. Maybe they should be allowed to play in orange all the time. Ditch the stripes. They've not been lucky for them, have they?
So, oh, my goodness. Play in orange. I can't believe you just said that.
Play in orange and become a different team altogether. They were extremely impressive. But, of course, Bournemouth are hopeless. So maybe West Ham can feel that, you know, they're not going to be that bad. But, they were, I would suggest people, if they haven't seen it, just watch the whole thing. Just watch the whole thing. It's great fun.
Oh, I'm sure I've heard that slogan somewhere. The future's bright, the future's orange. But anyhow, back onto West Ham, Gregor. If David Moyes does keep them up, do you think he will deserve the time and the money to sculpt his own squad?
It's a bit like the conversation we had last week about Steve Bruce. You know, it's.
Yeah.
I think West Ham just need to kind of decide or rediscover who they are. The way, you know, there's so many issues in the boardroom and the way the club's run and the recruitment policy, and, you know, there's any time that they have a blip, the stadium becomes another kind of cross on their back. So there's a lot of issues there, and. You know, if they want to have a manager who is very likely to keep them in the Premier League and survive in kind of mid-table, maybe slightly higher, then David Moyes would be a sound appointment in that regard. But if they want to, I don't know, show a little bit more ambition and just, like I say, rediscover their identity and a slightly more exciting way of playing football, which a lot of fans now crave, then they might have another decision to make in the summer.
I mean, when you think back to when they moved to the London Stadium, Alison, there were big promises about what that would bring for West Ham, the possibility of European nights. Can you really realistically see David Moyes delivering that?
There's another sigh.
No!
I don't think you can judge Moyes in isolation on this one.
No.
He's not had even if he keeps West Ham up, I don't think enough supporters are going to be enthusiastic about him being the person that the club build around, or the man who's allowed to build a team and forge its direction. And it's a very fragile ecosystem, the West Ham, with its stadium and everything. I think he's capable, David Moyes, of doing it, and I think he has proven isn't there something admirable about managers who just keep plugging away even though they know they're not popular. I just think that's I kind of like that. And it is possible to win people over slowly. And if they if West Ham were able to, if you took the good things from what they did against Chelsea, and there was a lot that was good, and I think probably most importantly was it was entertaining. If he could keep that going with a bit of dosh, I think he might slowly win more and more over. It's just not the sort of club where the people are patient, though. Mm. So it's looking at it sort of academically, I think, yes, give him a chance. But I just think there's so many things stacked against him, really. And it is difficult for managers. As soon as they start getting labelled as being good at some things and not good at others, they start running through sand in trying to prove themselves. And you sort of always feel at a club like West Ham that the owners will pull the rug the minute they decide, for whatever their own reasons are, it might be expedient not to back a manager to deflect something that's happened on a business level to blame the manager for or whatever. It's a complicated political club. So, but I mean, the crucial thing and the reason he ought to be given a nice big bottle of bubbly at the end of the season. How embarrassing would it be if they were playing in the Championship in that massive arena? It would be awful. They would be a laughing stock. So he has, if he keeps them up, he has earned the right to do something there, definitely. I just don't think there'll be the will that he needs to get that over the line, though.
So it was a disappointing night for Chelsea in their pursuit of a top four spot. And this morning, fingers are being pointed firmly at Marcos Alonso and Antonio Rudiger for their part in West Ham's winner. Alonso failed to track back, whilst Rudiger was accused of not doing enough to stop Yarmolenko cutting inside on his favoured left foot. Gary Neville on TV last night accused Rudiger of not knowing that Yarmolenko was left-footed and wasn't impressed with Alonso either. He said Marcos Alonso is level with him, when he's referring to Yarmolenko, at the point where that counter-attack starts, and he doesn't bother. Run back as fast as you can when your team lose the ball. You learn that age 6. Strong words, which we're quite used to from Gary Neville. Do you agree with what he has to say on that, Gregor?
Yes and no. I think the first thing to say is that Alonso is not Gary Neville, so he has a different outlook when that ball breaks, when Declan Rice kind of hooks the ball on. And, you know, Chelsea are going out to, you know, going to try and get the winner. And his thought is about staying in around the box for when it comes back in, or at least being an option for when Chelsea win the ball back and he can, you know, he's wide left. So I just think that in that stage of the game and that kind of phase of play, his thought process was more about attacking and trying to get a winner. And he completely switched off from seeing the danger that Yarmolenko posed. And clearly, it looked like he could have broken his neck a little bit more to run back afterwards. Rudiger, I think he got his angles wrong. He overcommitted. He went too far. I don't think it's true that he doesn't know he's a left footer. I think he thought about getting his body between the goal and the ball, and he overcommitted in one direction. And once you've done that, and the forward has the initiative, it's very hard to recover and change direction and get a block in. So Neville was typically strong, yes, but I think Alonso deserves more criticism than Rudiger does.
Mm. In that sense, when you talk about the defensive errors from Chelsea, did they allow West Ham back into the game last night, Alison? Or are you actually being a bit harsh on West Ham by saying that?
I think Chelsea looked tired. I would say Alonso's get out is that he's probably playing fullback in a back four isn't his best position, and he'd been on the whole game, and Yarmolenko had just come on, and he probably just knew he couldn't catch him. Maybe, I mean, maybe he just felt too tired at that point, and you've got five subs. Frank Lampard used them very well in the FA Cup, but he maybe didn't use them as well at the London Stadium. The interesting thing, I think, in terms of why that game was lost by Chelsea is Frank Lampard said afterwards, you can, with my team, see a blip coming. And it was though he was admitting he knew this was the night there was going to be another disappointment. It's as though he knows his team are promising and can sometimes deliver and sometimes look quite excellent, but he doesn't quite believe he's got the formula right for it to be a week in, week out reliable performance. And so he's constantly juggling his Lampard to trying to get it right for, you know, their level of tiredness, fitness, and who the opposition are. And he didn't get that quite right. But I would rather say, yes, there were two defensive errors. But the way Antonio cushioned the ball, he's a really good target man. The way he cushioned the ball, laid it off, made the run. I mean, you know, you can't knock that. That's proper skill. That's proper old-fashioned football. And his name was on the team sheet. The Chelsea defenders knew exactly what threat he would pose. That they failed to deal with it is to West Ham's credit. So I would say West Ham won it rather than Chelsea threw it away.
Well, that win for West Ham pushes them up to 16th and 3 points clear of the bottom three, which includes Eddie Howe's Bournemouth, who had an evening to forget, being swept aside 4-1 at home to Newcastle. The win included stunning goals from Miguel Almiron and Valentino Lazaro to inflict a crushing defeat on Howe's side, who grabbed a late consolation through Dan Gosling. Now, Alison, we've already touched on the fact that you were at the game. We've talked about how good Newcastle were, but how bad were Bournemouth?
Yeah, they were pretty dreadful, actually. They were off the pace. They were visibly not that mentally strong. Didn't have a lot of self-belief. They were bullied. They appeared to be bullied by the positivity of Newcastle. But Newcastle were very energetic and at them, and they didn't quite know how to respond to that. And you know, it's interesting because afterwards Eddie Howe said they're really struggling. He admitted they're struggling, that without having home fans there to give the team a lift when. Because they conceded very early in the game, it's around the fourth minute. And if you concede that early, then you know two things can happen: the home crowd can start getting on your back, or they can be supportive and urge you on, and you know do their version of "Never mind, chaps, you can get through this." But so the fact that Eddie Howe's admitting he needs that help to give the team the confidence to keep going for the next 86 minutes is, I don't know, he's got a point. He's got a point that the no crowds does affect the smaller clubs and the struggling clubs more, because the way you get a surprise result is often because the fans are so fantastic and provide some sort of intimidating backdrop and make players feel, you know, they're taller, better, faster than they actually are. But the fact that he admits that he needs that as part of the package to try and climb out of this precarious position he's in, it doesn't say a lot for his ability to motivate them. Because it did feel early goal, oh, you know, yet again, what are we going to do? They didn't look like they'd been told, no matter what happens to you, you can get through this. I suppose it's a very, very long-winded way of saying they looked fragile.
I just think that the fact that they lost, you know, they gifted Newcastle a goal within 5 minutes. That's the worst thing that can possibly happen to a team when they're down there. And I've been in that situation. And Eddie Howe as well looks absolutely crestfallen. He looks like, you know, he does not know which way to turn. You know, Sam Maximin twisted up the right side of Bournemouth's defence. For the second, no one really. Then you know, then it looks like confidence fell away. No one wanted to close down Almirón for the third, and the fourth was like the kind of the first run in the striker's playbook. It was like just a simple run in behind Ake and slip through. They just looked completely devoid of any confidence or belief for most of that game, I thought. So. I mean, it's so very hard to turn that around. I mean, Eddie Howe's been there a long time. He knows these players. it just looks very hard. It looks like it's impossible for him to get a reaction from them now.
Alison, it's interesting, as Gregor mentioned, you know, 5 minutes into the game, they've conceded. Did it look as though their heads dropped as soon as that happened? Or did they show any fight at all?
No, yeah, I mean, it wasn't quite... They looked like the kid who doesn't want to go to school because they're being bullied. And mum says, look, if it happens again, what you do is you just look them in the eye and say, oh, bullies are just very weak people who are struggling in life. And then hold your head up high and carry on, find a friend. And so they've gone into the school playground and they're immediately bullied and they've forgotten everything mummy said and they just want to go home. They're just not coping very well with being in the position they're in. They're just not. Mm. There's a collective lack of belief there, I think. And I mean, who can blame them? I mean, have you seen their running? I wrote in my piece, there's no respite. Next up, it's Manchester United, Tottenham Hotspur, Leicester, then Man City. But then their last two games are Everton and Southampton. There are no... if Newcastle were... If we're now looking at a list where they hadn't played Newcastle yet, you'd say, well, maybe they could get something against Newcastle. And then they were comprehensively outplayed against Newcastle. So I know football doesn't work that way, but you've got to say there's something radically has to change for them to get anything against any of those clubs I just listed.
Are they doomed then, Alison? Are they down in your eyes?
I don't really want them to be, but... I mean, who dislikes Bournemouth? I mean, and they are one of the... I think we forget. I think mainly we forget because Leicester pulled off the ultimate fairy tale. But Bournemouth are a fairy tale club. And they're a club that rose through the ranks under Eddie Howe. He did a great job. And then when they were promoted, people said, oh, well, they won't stay there. They're very small. But they did. And he's... And on that basis alone, you think it's a lovely story and they're a well-run club and, you know, it's a tiny stadium, but they make it work. And you would like them. You would like them to rediscover what it was that gave them that resilience to defy the odds and keep going. But I suppose everything is in cycles, and that sense of togetherness... that they probably, you know, put together there, the fact they know they're a long-term project. I mean, that must help a lot, knowing that your manager's going to be there the following season and the season after that. And there's a family atmosphere, and it gives Eddie Howe the power to only sign players that he feels he can work with. That's all good and well, but it's just run out. Everyone around them is getting... savvier and richer and more ruthless, and they've sort of, in a strange way, they seem quite old-fashioned suddenly, I think.
Well, after the game, Eddie Howe insisted that he does not need the board's explicit blessing to stay in the job. He said, I don't need assurances. The club will do what is best for them. We have a very open and honest relationship. If the club felt it wanted to go in a different direction, that's up to them. My emotional energy is not in doubt. Gregor, what do you think should happen with Bournemouth? Should they be making a change?
I think if they want to have a shot at survival, then the answer is yes. But I think if you're looking at the bigger picture, Eddie Howe has done such an extraordinary job there. I think they kind of need to gauge his mood as well. I think he did look kind of crestfallen, and I think they need to see what he's... You know, he said that he's emotionally invested in it, but he doesn't really look at it anymore. I think he looks completely lost, devoid of ideas now. I think his team doesn't look like his team anymore. It used to be such a fast counter attacking team, really dynamic. They pressed well. You know, they've always had kind of holes at the back. they've played with some players who kind of come up from League One. And again, you know, you look at their team, and it used to be Harry Arthur, Simon Francis, Cook, Daniels. There's a lot of people who who, as I say, had been part of that journey, and they sort of that was almost their identity, and the people who came in were kind of supplementing that. And there has been an issue with the recruitment. They seem to have developed, you know, cultivated this relationship with Liverpool, where they take their cast-offs and for about £40 million in total, and none of them have done anything. Harry Wilson's scored a few free kicks and been not bad on loan this season, but Jordan Ibe, Dom Solanke, Brad Smith, been a disaster. And they're, you know, I don't think the recruitment has been good enough either. So once that core of the team has been transitioned out, then you are reliant on the recruitment and it's not been good enough.
Recruitment's not been good enough, so that may be one of the reasons as to why things are not working for Eddie Howe right now. Alison, has he earned the right to go down and try and bring them back up again?
Yes, definitely. I don't know for sure, but I suspect if you did a poll of fans, they would say they'd be okay with going down and Eddie Howe being the one to bring them back up. I mean, I think they'd be naive to think it would be that easy. The Championship just gets more and more competitive and unpredictable, and he might find it hard, even with that group of players in the Championship. But I do think there's a lot of goodwill towards Eddie Howe. And it was, you know, I only saw him on the Zoom chat. It would be nice to be able to do the old-fashioned press conferences. But even on the Zoom chat, I've spoken to a lot of managers who are on the brink of being sacked, and they go sort of glassy-eyed, and you can tell they're speaking almost rehearsed lines and their head somewhere else, and they're a bit worried. He didn't look like that, Eddie Howe. He obviously does have a good relationship with the board, and if I had to put money on it, I would say they're not going to dump him and hope to get in someone who can be a firefighter. But no, I'll be proved wrong, won't I? I just don't get that feeling that they're going to do that. I think if they were going to do that, they'd have done that a few months back before lockdown, when Eddie Howe actually admitted he might be running out of ideas, and they stuck with him then. So I think they will stick with him. Ironically, I think because their running is so difficult, that's almost now a positive. Maybe, you know, it frees you up a tiny bit to know that you're really now not expected to win any of those games, and maybe that'll allow the players to just rediscover a bit of urgency and self-belief.
Gregor, can managers go stale? With Eddie Howe, it's only Wickham's Gareth Ainsworth that's been in the same managerial position longer than the Bournemouth boss. We know at Manchester United, Sir Alex Ferguson would obviously attempt to revamp the squad, and if that didn't work, he would change his number two. Do you feel that maybe Eddie Howe needs to change things up coaching-wise, because maybe it's not working and he's become a little stale with the group that he has right now?
I mean, it certainly looks like things have gone stale, but I mean, as I say, I know, knowing that he does actually every single summer and throughout the season, in fact, he's always looking at any little improvements he can make and any little tweaks to his coaching, to the preparations, to everything about the football club. He's, you know, he's kind of the all-seeing eye over that club, and he's built it from nearly falling out of the Football League to a Premier League club that's kind of was well established and pretty to watch. But I think it can go. I have to say, I've never played for a manager for long enough to know whether it can go stale like that, because it doesn't happen very often. I just think, I honestly think that them losing the core of the players who have been so successful for them, and I can see, you know, if you do look at the recruitment, you can see that he's kind of almost tried to replace that with like a core of English players. He signed Lloyd Kelly from Bristol City, Jack Stacey from Luton this year. Every year there's a couple: David Brooks, Chris Meppham from Brentford. You know, paying decent figures and fees for these young kind of up and coming British players. But I think, Brooks aside, they've not really done enough, and it's not quite enough for the Premier League now. So it's tough to watch, and it's tough to to fight your way out of, to be honest.
Before we move on, Alison, you wrote in your piece on Bournemouth how Newcastle were helped by the new drinks breaks in the Premier League games taken in the middle of each half. What was happening in the game for you to think that it helped Steve Bruce's side?
There was just this brief resurgence is a too strong word, maybe, but Bournemouth did actually summon a few attacks. And at that very point, the first drinks break came. I don't know what Steve Bruce would have said, but I'm pretty sure he'd have said something along the lines of let's restart like we started the match. Let's not let them get into any sort of rhythm. But it was more a case of it came at a bad time for Bournemouth. But that's only with hindsight, because looking across the whole match, that was the only period where they looked really like they had some sense of adventure. So it was just an interruption. Now, it could have been, in the old days, an interruption because there was an injury or some sort of contentious decision, but you wouldn't be able to get the team together in the same way and just repeat a message. So it clearly allowed Steve Bruce to reiterate what he'd said before they took to the field. And I think if you'd been Eddie Howe at that point, it would have been really hard to know what to say, because they'd had a couple of forays forward. They hadn't done much. It wasn't like he had much to grab hold of and say, look how well you just did in the last 10 minutes. It was a fleeting glimpse of something positive. And I think he'd have much preferred to have just let them generate their own momentum, if that was at all possible, rather for them to have a break and then remember how rubbish they were.
Of course, there have been some managers who've been quite vocal in their opposition to the drinks break. Gregor, what do you think about it? Are you a fan of it? Can you understand those managers that don't like it? And do players really need it?
I can understand why it was introduced, because I think the Premier League and clubs are looking for any way to mitigate against against injuries and the sheer workload that's going to be placed on players now in this month. So I can understand why it was introduced, but I can also see why it does interrupt play, and if teams in kind of full flow, it's an interruption to that. So I think it's fine that it's here between now and the end of the season, but it has to be thrown in the bin afterwards.
Hello, I'm Stig Abel.
I'm Asma Mir, and you can hear our breakfast programme on Times Radio.
Join us as we talk to special guests about everything you need to know for the day ahead.
Listen to our morning show for free on DAB Radio, your smart speaker, at times.radio and via our Times Radio app. Every Monday to Thursday, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Times Radio. Know your times.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now to a sad and shocking story from the Championship. Wigan Athletic entered into administration on Wednesday, the first professional club to do so in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, and are set to be handed a 12-point penalty by the EFL. Administrators in charge of Wigan say several parties have expressed an interest in buying the Championship club and must now prove they have funds of at least £10 million to progress in negotiations. Paul Stanley, Gerald Krasner and Dean Watson from Begbie's Trainer have been appointed as joint administrators. In fact, I was speaking to Paul Stanley this morning. He is hopeful that they can get a buyer and that they will be able to save Wigan. But it certainly sounds like a very, very desperate situation that they are in. He was even putting out a plea to Wigan fans to help if they can in any way contribute, to just pay expenses, for example, for the rest of this season. Now, a deal to sell Wigan from the Hong Kong-based International Entertainment Corporation to the next Leader Fund was only formally completed on June the 4th, with an investigation likely to follow on how a club can enter administration just 4 weeks after a sale. This story caught us all by surprise, Gregor, and I know you've been writing about it in the Times. How on earth has this happened?
It's pretty hard to get your head around it. There's two things, really. The takeover that happened on June 4th was between two Hong Kong-based companies, both of which were owned by the same man, majority owned by the same man, a man called Stanley Choi, who's actually a kind of high-stakes poker player as well. I think a memorandum of understanding for that sale was first entered into back in November. So, you know, there's a few things that are raised by that, and the first is that they're trying to sort of suggest that COVID-19 is a reason for the sale when COVID wasn't really a thing in November. They've also cited Brexit. They cited the failure of the club to reach the Premier League. I think the wording in their statement was a misalignment of expectations. So it really looks like a year after buying the club from Dave Whelan, they thought the club is, as most championship clubs do, is losing close to £1 million a month. We don't really think that we've got much chance of getting Wigan into the Premier League. It's not as easy as we thought. Let's set in motion a process of shutting up shop. And, you know, it's very difficult to know how this could have been prevented, because, as I say, when the transaction took place last month from one company to another, it was the same man who owned the company. So it looks like he's basically rearranging his portfolio. But the thing that happened then, 8 days ago, on June 24th, is someone who was previously a minority shareholder in the new company became majority shareholder. So at that point, someone who is really an unknown became owner of the club. And at that point, there was no more funding for the club. And that's really why they've had to enter administration.
So with all that being said, Gregor, the EFL have come in for a lot of stick in this situation. But it sounds as though you're suggesting that perhaps they wouldn't have expected this to happen, because the original majority owner of this other company that obviously owns Wigan did have the proof of funds originally. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, but I think he probably would have had to go through the whole process again, and there's no reason why he wouldn't have the proof of funds.
Yes, because he's transferred it, but he still owned the other company.
Yeah, so that first part is really, I don't think we can really lay any blame at the EFL's door for that, because although it changed hands between the same man, yes, essentially. Yes. So the thing that needs some scrutiny is the fact that it could be signed off that somebody else became owner of that company and owner of Wigan Athletic Football Club very easily, it seems, or too easily. But again, the EFL, this is a kind of becoming an age-old sort of issue now. The EFL are a members' club. The clubs create their own rules, and so they have been since the demise of Bury a year ago. They have been in discussions about changing the ownership rules, and part of that is the owners and directors test. But it's hard to see how even a more stringent owners and directors test would necessarily have prevented this from happening. It is easy to lay the blame at the EFL's door. But the EFL's argument is that the test is to ascertain whether A, the person has the means, and that they're suitable, i.e. they're not a convicted criminal. There's no way of them ascertaining whether they have the capability, whether they're actually good enough to do it, or how are they supposed to know that what looks like has happened is they've just said, we're no longer funding the club. The EFL could never know that was going to happen. So it's very hard for Wigan, and the thing is that this sort of illuminates is that when foreign investors buy football clubs, and not just foreign investors, any investor who's not, which, you know, Dave Whelan was like a relic of from the past. He was a local guy who owned JGB Sports, became very wealthy, bought his local club, took them from the third tier, the fourth tier even, to the Premier League, won the FA Cup. That's a kind of old school kind of fairy tale, and everyone says that's lovely. But when a consortium from Hong Kong comes along, and they don't have that same attachment to the club, it feels like you are always taking some sort of risk in allowing them to take what's going to be essentially an investment for them.
It just sounds like a desperately dire situation, obviously, at Wigan, and there's real fear about their future. They are 14th at present, with six games to go. If they finish outside the bottom three, then the 12-point deduction, if not appealed, would apply to the 2019-20 table. But if they're relegated, the deduction would apply at the start of the 2020-21 League One campaign. Administrator Gerald Krasner has warned that Wigan could be the first of a number of EFL clubs to go bust. He says, "It's my personal view that there are a number of clubs in the lower divisions, Leagues One and Two, that may not survive by coming back. There's the possibility at least one Championship club may seriously be thinking about doing the same." Krasner insists there is enough cash flow until the end of the season, but no more, having also reduced Leeds' debts from £103 million to £24 million as chairman back in 2004, so that may be why the name is familiar to some. He says he already has 12 interested parties and hopes at least two serious bidders will emerge. He claims the starting price for Wigan, as I mentioned before, is £10 million because of their liabilities, and has told all interested parties to provide proof of funds. Alison, we heard what Gerald Krasner there had to say about the future of Leagues 1 and 2 clubs. Are we concerned that other EFL clubs may suffer the same fate as Wigan are suffering right now?
Well, no, not exactly the same fate, because as Gregor has very eloquently explained, this is a very specific set of peculiar problems at Wigan. And that won't be the reason that other clubs face administration. It will be simply that they can't cope with the problems imposed by COVID and their cash flow issues. So at some point, there's a lot ahead problem-wise on this, because if they go ahead and deduct points for Wigan and then a raft of clubs go into administration because of cash flow problems, are they going to have 5, 10, 15 clubs all being deducted points. The league table is going to look ridiculous. I mean, I've got a soft spot from Wigan, but it really grates that who is punished by the deduction. It's not the owner that's decided or made a mistake. They have no emotional attachment to the club, and they just want out because it was an adventure that went wrong. You're only punishing players who've done really well to haul themselves out of the relegation zone. Manager has done really well to do the same, and of course the fans who've stuck through Wigan through that horrible fall from grace from the moment they won the FA Cup. See, so in what way is this? You're not punishing the people who are doing potentially the things that are wrong. I mean, we don't know the ins and outs, and we don't know how much of this is deliberate and how much of this is cynical. So there's a caveat in that. But it does seem, with Wigan, what has gone wrong has been hard-nosed business talk and people thinking they've possibly made a mistake. So why do they care about points deduction and what the long-term implications of that for that club? It doesn't make sense. And equally, why would you go around giving points deductions to clubs who were not able to cope with football behind closed doors or truncated seasons? That makes no sense either. I think football needs to rethink its crime and punishment rules, to be quite honest, in the light of COVID. But this, I have to reiterate, this is not, like Gregor said, using COVID with Wigan is an excuse. This is not the reason they're in trouble at the moment. Although, if other clubs are in trouble, that probably will be because of the pandemic.
It's a very difficult situation, obviously, that Wigan find themselves in right now. And the former Wigan midfielder, Ben Watson, who scored that winner in the 2013 FA Cup final you've just alluded to, Alison, has spoken to the Times today about his shock at the announcement. He said, "I called one of my friends from the Wigan Athletic team to congratulate him for beating Stoke City. The win put them 14th in the Championship table, unbeaten in 9 games. Then the devastating news came. After the call, I heard about the club going into administration. My friend hadn't mentioned it, and I'm not sure how much the players were even aware of what was going on. All of this shows what the pandemic has done. For this to come out of the blue is such an eye-opener for everyone in football. Wigan may be the first, but they certainly won't be the last." Gregor, how on earth are the Wigan players going to handle this situation?
I've only been in it once when I was at Rotherham United, and I think it really, the truth is, it kind of creates a bit of a siege mentality. I would not be surprised to see Wigan surviving, although they've got a 4-point gap to make up now, and they have the best form of any team except Derby since New Year's Day. They were bottom of the table on New Year's Day, and since then I think only Derby have taken more points than them, so it's been a remarkable run. And I think really it focuses minds. It's like you think, to hell with them, to hell with everyone. We're gonna try and pull off something pretty remarkable here. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Wigan do that. I mean, just to kind of reiterate again what Alison said, and what Ben Watson's saying here is, that's on the face of it, it does look like yes, this is what. This is Wigan will be the first of many, and they might be, because the Championship is the biggest financial basket case in England. I think the average wages to turnover ratio is 107%, and Wigan's was 168. Reading's was 226. So for every £100 they earned, they spent 226 on wages in the last financial year. So that gives you an idea of how crazy it is. And the thing is, COVID could be an excuse for some of these people. And it is a tightrope. Alison's saying, the crime doesn't fit the punishment, and there is a clause, there's something called a force majeure clause that allows Wigan to appeal to a point sanction. But if a club was allowed to just go into administration, pay very little of their debts, full amount of their debts to whoever they owe them to, and they wouldn't be punished for it, then why would every club not do that? Because so many clubs are spending extortionate amounts of money at the moment and losing huge amounts of money when there's no fans inside the stadium. So it's very difficult, but I would say that the players actually will almost be galvanised by this, and I wouldn't be surprised to see Wigan stay up despite it all.
Well, Wigan, a story we will continue to track for you here on the Game podcast, as well as, of course, at the Times as well. That is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to Alison as well. Remember, you can subscribe to the Times and the Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search the Times subscription for more information. We will be back with you on Monday on the Game podcast. Stay safe and enjoy your weekend.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.